The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
In March 2014, what began as a search for a missing motorcycle taxi driver in the outskirts of Ibadan, Nigeria, would uncover a scene that would haunt the community and the nation forever. A horrifying discovery quickly sparked rumors of ritual killings, human trafficking, and dark magic practices that sent shockwaves across Nigeria, even reaching top elected officials. To this day, the events surrounding the Soka Forest remain a mystery, with nobody credibly accused of the evils uncovered there. But as late as 2023, the number of killings and missing persons has been on the rise again, prompting many to wonder if a satanic cult is responsible and returning for revenge.
Hello, citizen. This content creator is a confirmed conspiracy theorist and has been subject to repeated penalties for spreading controversial rhetoric. Please proceed with caution. Trust the government. Remain silent. Your compliance is appreciated and, of course, non-negotiable.
Welcome to the 21CD podcast. If you're looking for a sign that you may be in danger, this is it. As always, I'm your ghost, John, here today, but tomorrow is never promised. So protect your kids, protect yourself, and always question the narrative. And if you like the show, Google us and follow us everywhere. And please also check out 21CDstudios.com for merch and other stuff.
Warning, this episode is graphic and contains discussion on extremely sensitive topics, graphic imagery, and intense themes that may cause distress. Viewer discretion is advised.
A young man named Abakuta arrived at work as expected on Friday, March 21st in the year 2014. He was a well-known motorcycle taxi driver in Ibadan, Nigeria. They call these motorcycle taxis okadas in Nigeria, and they are a very tight-knit community, often coming together on important issues and representing the working class as a whole. Abakuta, a member of the 1 Million Boys group, was well known and respected in the community. Which is why it was so concerning when he simply vanished. Abakuta was seen leaving Ibadan sometime around midday on Friday. When leaving the city, the Okadas knew it was best not to go alone, thanks to rampant crime in Nigeria, which can include anything from murder by violent extremists to abduction by satanic organ farmers. Unfortunately for Abakuta, it would be the latter of these options that would assume control of his fate. His friends and family amassed in a group, trying to decide how to approach the crisis of his sudden disappearance. He wasn't answering his phone. Nobody really knew where he was. Panic was beginning to ensue. Emotions were high, and there was a palpable tension in the air. Then, someone's ringtone pierced the chaos sharply. It was Abakuta. The phone call from Abakuta would be short and fragmented and filled with desperation, the kind of communication that leaves more questions than answers. Imagine just the static, laden voice of a man speaking in hushed, panicked tones. He's fearful that someone might overhear him. The background is filled with these muffled sounds that appear to be from other captives. Abakuta somehow relays that there are maybe 8 of them, and they are trapped, being held captive underground. Allegedly, he was able to provide some landmarks with the little battery power and signal he had left, and these landmarks were well described, fortunately. A path near the Ibadan forest, perhaps some burned-out vehicles nearby, these tips would ensure his friend's arrival promptly. He might struggle to breathe, as if in a confined space in these moments, catching his breath between phrases. His words were probably jumbled and panicked, slipping in and out of coherence, and in all the chaos of being kidnapped, he may have remembered some things wrong as well. He wasn't exactly, it seems, shown where they were going, so he would have had to piece things together as he noticed and remembered them on his way to wherever he was being taken. And he just keeps repeating that he's being held, but he can't really say by whom or exactly where. And his friends try to calm him down, but it's very clear that he's fearing for his life, as are the people in the background. All he really knows is that he's below the ground in some hidden place, and he thinks it's somewhere near the Ibadan forest. Then there's just this sharp click. And he's gone. And all that's left is this silence, with everybody on the other end just trying to figure out what the heck is going on. So his friends attempt to call him back, but the phone just answers with silence. Now, this call would leave those who received it terrified and confused. Terrified because cannibalism, torture, murder, occult blood magic practices, these are all things that run rampant in Nigeria. As if the guerrilla warfare and crime syndicates were not enough, Abakuta provided no ransom value, though, which implied that he was sort of abducted for a much more sinister reason. Nigeria is also widely known to have a body farm problem. And that's exactly what it sounds like, folks. Farms hidden deep in the forests and jungles and even residential areas that keep humans for nothing more than the harvesting of their body parts for black market trade and ritualistic occult magic practices. Any citizen should realistically be encouraged to call the police. So that's exactly what Abakuta's friends, family, and members of the 1 Million Boys group do. They alert the police. And any citizen should realistically expect that the police would care. Unfortunately, in this situation, fairly typical for the region, the police did not care. So they essentially told the Okadas to just go check it out and let us know if you find anything. And already having extremely low expectations of their police, the Okadas did exactly that. They were prepared to go, fully expecting that the cops weren't going to help. The tension among the initial 60 or so Okada riders racing to find the Soka forest, it was no doubt electric. And I'm sure that they were experiencing a very raw mix of fear and urgency in this moment. But at the same time, I'm sure many of these men knew the boundaries of what they could expect. In most Western countries, finding a body in the woods is quite shocking and might send one of us to therapy for years afterwards. In Nigeria, finding 100 bodies in the woods is only somewhat shocking, as the issue of missing and murdered family members is very prevalent in the lives of so many Nigerians. They know all about the body factories and all about the occult organ farming and the corrupt officials and the medicine men and women who snatch up babies and the socially outcast or the medically incompetent, the mentally incompetent. This is a real problem in Nigeria. There is a very sort of defined structure of humanity, and they still believe that in Nigeria, if you're sort of on this lower end of the spectrum in society, you're not really a real human being, and therefore your body parts being farmed is actually not only somewhat expected, but also something that the officials don't really do anything about, at least not in 2014 and this time. So as the riders gathered, I'm sure the air was thick with this sort of sense of dread. Word had spread already that one of their own had gone missing by now, and it wasn't the first Okada to go missing in recent history, so there was a sense of urgency. This, as a matter of fact, would have been the third Okada in recent history that went missing, which is one reason they were ready to just be done with the whole thing and try to catch the guys who were guilty. So their engines are roaring to life on their back of motorcycles, and they're speeding down these dusty roads. The deeper they rode, the thicker the trees grew. They were going deeper and deeper into this sort of miniature wilderness that was kind of surrounded by inhabited areas. And as they neared this Soka forest area, they realized that though the landscape is thickly wooded, there are still some residential areas nearby. So Abakuda might not be unsavable. There might be other people around here who know what's going on. And whether they found these burned out cars or some other landmark is kind of uncertain, but the Okadas were eventually able to locate this overgrown path that Abakuda had mentioned in his phone call. And this was an area that was so dense and the path was so overgrown that these dudes had to basically walk no more than maybe two of them abreast to each other. And they're going through these trees, kind of being quiet because Abakuda had told them that they would be able to hear him screaming, essentially, and these other eight people with him. But as they went further and further down this path, they were beginning to wonder if they were in the right place at all, because they could not hear any screaming, and it seemed like the forest was just growing thicker and thicker and thicker. The path didn't seem like it was used very regularly. They weren't really sure what was going on or where they were going. And then out of nowhere, allegedly, a group of several gunmen came out of the trees and just began firing their guns off into the air. And I've heard YouTube accounts saying that it was just one lone gunman, and I've heard Nigerians who were actually present say that it was a few gunmen. Whatever the case may be, somebody popped out of the woods and started a shooting. And so, as one would expect, the 60 Okada, fearing for their lives and being suddenly ambushed, fled. And they tore off down the path back to their motorcycles and ripped away back to Ibadan. And once they were there, they again alerted the police, who still did not want to come help. So they gathered like 40 or 50, some say 100 more people, more of these Okadas and regular people who were willing to help. And this small citizen army armed themselves with basically any blunt or bladed weapon that they could find. So we're talking machetes, bats, pieces of wood, farm equipment, tools. And without wasting any time, they tore off back to the forest. I seriously cannot even say that I've ever witnessed such a community union. This many people united to save one of their own at the peril of their own lives and out of complete lack of faith in anyone but themselves. It's inspiring, and we definitely don't portray such dedication to each other here in the United States in this modern age. Absolutely not. If I went missing tomorrow, literally nobody would even notice I was missing till like 3 weeks go by, and then maybe I'd get a phone call asking if I was coming back to work. But either way, the now 100 or more, 200, who knows, how many men are stomping through the forest, right? And they're yelling, and they're waving their weapons, and they're hitting trees. They want the villains of the wood to know that they will be coming en masse and violently. Because in real life, sometimes it actually does take violence to achieve righteous results. But this group does not encounter any gunmen. Instead, they find themselves in this abrupt clearing in the forest. And over yonder, a river sort of flows through the clearing, and they see several structures. Again, I've read many accounts on this situation, this moment in time. I've read so much about what happened, and I've heard differing tales, basically. But it appears that many of the YouTubers discussing this are regurgitating some information, misinformation, I should say. Because there were several abandoned house-like structures and residential buildings, a small black shack, and a large warehouse. In some accounts, you see that this was just like a lone structure in the woods. This was actually a mini compound, okay? And on top of all this, there was a substantial residential region surrounding this little Soka Forest, Ibadan Forest, House of Horrors area. So there were people actively living in the area, okay? In other words, this area was essentially in an inner city forest, this clearing, and the locals should have noticed it. Yes, they had to go through the woods, but it's a bit like a big park in the middle of a city, like a big forested region in this city. So it's not like maybe somebody wouldn't have heard something or seen something. I want to make that clear because I feel like that's something that's not mentioned enough in accounts of the Ibadan House of Horror. The Okadas had to traverse some rough hilly terrain once they entered this clearing, because the clearing is basically, it's a hill that goes down to the river and then a hill on the opposite side of the river that goes up towards all these structures. And according to some sources, as they were crossing the river, one of the Okadas actually spotted Abakuta's bike sort of hidden in the brush on the river's edge. Some others say it was found underneath a bridge, but when I did some Google mapping and some digging, I didn't actually find a bridge across this particular river, so I'm not sure where the bridge would have been. But either way, of course, their zeal for this venture was reinvigorated upon seeing evidence that their buddy was here at one point. Later, some of the men were asked how they were able to find this place, and they responded with essentially, "The police would not help us, so we had to rely on our Yoruba means."
The victim that was abducted by the hounds on Friday is my friend. He is from Kudeti and his name is Abakuta. Since last Saturday that we discovered and exposed this place, we have not seen government take any meaningful step at it. Although they brought caterpillars today, but we are not impressed, as yet they have not done the significant work. So we decided to trace through our native, Yoruba, means. We detected through our means that the victim is around this place.
This can be interpreted several different ways. Ironically, the Yoruba means usually involves some kind of use of magic, shaman guidance, sometimes even ritualistic sacrifice of animals or people. And many people blame the Yoruba ways for the body factories themselves and the prevalence of occult murders in Nigeria. The Yoruba religious tradition has influenced other spiritual practices around the world, especially in the Americas, where enslaved Yoruba people brought their beliefs. This is how it typically happens. And these traditions evolved into religions like Santeria in Cuba, Candomblé in Brazil, and Voodoo in Haiti, often blending with elements of Catholicism and local practices. I could go down the whole list of these religions and others inspired by Yoruba and basically outline their similarities and differences, but I think to keep this concise, I'll just leave you with this. All of these beliefs hinge on occult magic practices, human and animal sacrifices, blood magic, sometimes cannibalism, and the existence of multiple deities, which can at times include the saints from Catholic beliefs. So it's ironic that the two sides of this sort of religion were battling each other in this jungle. The perpetrators of atrocities that are about to be discussed are also rumored to be followers of Yoruba. That's right. I said R also, because they're still out there. After scaling the steep hill on the other side, the throng of men arrived at this small, decaying structure. It was a shack, blackened with age and neglect, kind of small, and some assumed that this was a guard shack, as it had one window that was sort of facing the tree line. So cautiously, a few of the braver men burst through the door, yelling and preparing to either die or club a Satanist to death. And inside, the air was so thick, and there was this scent of sort of damp earth and something far more unsettling, which is the smell and feeling of molding and decaying clothing and personal belongings. And scattered across the floor, piled high against the walls and hanging from makeshift hooks, were literally hundreds of articles of clothing. There were shirts, trousers, dresses, headscarves, all tangled together in this chaotic sea of fabric. Shoes of every single size and type lay in disordered heaps, along with purses, wallets, children's toys, and other personal belongings. One rider knelt down and sort of picked up this child's shoe and saw that its bright color was dulled by a thin layer of dust. So obviously, the other articles were not dulled by dust. So what that basically is saying is people are being brought here across a span of time. And this realization sort of hit the group like an actual physical punch in the chest, because it was basically signaling that you're about to find a tomb. But their resolve was firm, and they began yelling even louder, beginning to scan the surroundings for any evidence of Abakuta. The wind shifted outside, and many began to sort of report smells of rot and death. But by now, everyone was expecting to find a body, so that wasn't really shocking anybody. The group of 100 or more men sort of fractured into several smaller groups to explore all of these abandoned structures around them. And one of those group moves on to the warehouse. Right around this time, Abakuta calls again. And he says that he can hear voices and thinks that the crowd of guys looking for him must be near. Before they can narrow down exactly where Abakuta may have been buried, though, the call drops again, sending the men into even more frustration. And unfortunately, this would be the last time that Abakuta would manage to get a call off. They directed their attention to this warehouse that was in this area, part of this group of buildings. They figured maybe there was an entrance to a dungeon in there. Its windows were very high on the walls, completely inaccessible and sort of barred, as if the building itself was sort of trying to keep what was inside hidden from view. And there was a tall chain link fence surrounding the warehouse, topped with barbed wire. So the riders gathered at the fence and they sort of grabbed it and they began shouting at the building. They were both telling anyone who could be inside and be dangerous to come out and face their fate, and also shouting to potential prisoners that, hey, it's safe out here. Come on out. We're here to help. But nobody answered. There was only silence. So one of the guys brandished a pair of bolt cutters, and with each snap of the cutters against the metal links, the fence began to give way. And finally it did, and all of these men charged toward the warehouse. And they sort of stopped short before a large piece of sheet metal that had been propped against the entrance of the warehouse. It's basically the only way in. And it looked like this piece of sheet metal was just hastily placed, as if it was meant to seal something inside rather than keep anybody out. And they heaved this piece of metal aside, revealing a poorly hidden entrance that was really little more than just a big hole in the wall, like a big opening, but not like an official door. So steeling themselves, they pushed through, their flashlights sort of bobbing against the walls through the darkness as they stepped inside. And again, the air is very dense and dirty. It really smells bad in here. And then they saw them. Bodies. They were surrounded by bodies. Some skeletal, others in various states of decay, scattered haphazardly across the concrete floor, but mainly up against the walls. And the dim beams of their flashlight really reveal the scene that everybody in their right mind would have called a nightmare. There were limbs sort of twisted in unnatural positions, bodies missing limbs altogether. There were scratch marks on the walls, broken fingernails, and bloodstains smeared across the floor. And in the corner of the room, a few emaciated figures huddled together, alive, but barely clinging to life, probably not really knowing who these people are, or why they're here, or if they're all about to be finally put out of their misery. Their lips were all broken, and their mouths were too dry. They couldn't speak. None of them could speak. It was clear that they had been here for days, weeks, or months. And the stench of decay, as people constantly reported, was horrid. Like, it could be smelled for miles around. So the sight of human suffering, the smell, it really brought together the realization of the atrocities that had been committed within these walls, and it kind of hit the guys all at once. They started dropping to their knees, praying. Others had to flee the building. As they're sort of scrambling out of the building and trying to take these prisoners with them, the other men also began screaming from further away that they too were finding bodies everywhere. There were skulls and heads just littered all around the property. Still others began to report from the other buildings that people were being found chained and tied to the walls. A lot of these people are missing body parts. They began cutting them down. And as they cut them down from the walls, a bunch of these victims actually just fled into the forest. It was said that they scattered to the hills and were unavailable for questioning. Nobody knows who they were. They just, out of fear and seeing their one moment of escape, they fled from their rescuers. And unfortunately, that obviously created a problematic situation where you're missing potential sources of information, witnesses, people who could help you piece together the picture. But I don't know, in this situation, I might flee into the woods as well. Overall, the remains of somewhere between 100 and 300 people were discovered in the buildings and immediately around the buildings. Bodies were hanging in the trees, shoved in between rocks or under bushes. Dozens and dozens of skulls were simply laying around everywhere. Some say an alligator was found and a guillotine as well in sort of execution room off of the main warehouse structure. Both grim methods of execution and disposal of people who had reached their maximum usefulness, their body parts being cut off one by one for sale to practitioners of witchcraft and black market dealers until there was basically too little left of them to survive. There were slabs of concrete found tilted on one corner with a blood bowl at the following corner. And it was on these slabs individuals would have allegedly had their body parts cut off and their organs removed or their blood drained. And these types of slabs are commonly found in Nigeria, often being used for animal and human sacrifice or mutilation. Because again, this is a widespread problem. 23 survivors, each barely clinging to life, each step a struggle against the physical and the mental torment that they had endured. These survivors were gaunt and ghost-like. Their eyes were sunken. They had clearly been starved. Their skin was stretched tight over their bones. So the riders moved among the survivors, obviously searching their faces and their features, hoping to find a familiar face among them. But as we already mentioned, Abakuda, the missing Okada rider who had driven them on this desperate search, was nowhere to be seen. So the survivors, you know, tried to help them as much as they could, but they weren't able to relay any useful information whatsoever about Abakuda. Around the warehouse, the scene continued to grow even more macabre as the riders kind of fanned out. They uncovered hastily dug graves scattered throughout the overgrown lot behind the buildings, shallow mounds of earth barely covering the remains within. All of this sort of hinted at this grim attempt to basically keep the smell to as much of a minimum as possible. And one by one, the riders began to dig, because many of them were missing friends and family, besides Abakuta. And they uncovered more decomposing bodies and skeletal remains, nearly all of them missing pieces and parts. The mass graves were really a testament to the atrocities committed here because, in all, it's not exactly known how many people were buried in the graves. All those bodies that they did find, that does not include the people that were underground. Despite the relief of finding these survivors, the realization of what had been done to the many whose lives had ended in these shallow pits clearly weighed heavily on the riders' hearts and minds, and as they looked upon the scene, they couldn't help but wonder about Abakuta. If he wasn't here among the living or the dead that they uncovered, then where could he be? They remembered his call saying that he was underground and that he thought he could hear them above him. But since his last call, they haven't been able to find any access to any underground dungeon or wherever he may be. They searched everything. So with no other options, and obviously the gravity of the situation impossible to ignore, the riders called the authorities again. This time, being told about this situation, the police finally came, and they brought construction vehicles with them. Because they were going to dig up the earth in search of underground tunnels. Allegedly. But what it seemed like happened instead was a total cover-up of the whole thing. People even saying they're not digging where we told them to dig. They're not digging where our friend said he heard us. They're digging in other places. Before bodies could be recovered and identified, and before a proper investigation was ever performed, they demolished the buildings and buried everything in the earth. Abakuta was lost forever, along with so many others. As one can imagine, this triggered a massive unrest among the locals who had missing family members and friends. An opportunity arose to give these people maybe the peace and clarity of discovering their missing loved ones, but the police just snuffed it out, essentially. And this immediately reinforced the suspicions that politicians were in on this thing. The police were in on it. It is widely believed that many of these individuals in power in Nigeria have used human sacrifice or magic involving human body parts to achieve their desires and their offices. They do this by essentially paying witch doctors to perform such actions over and for them. And such practices are not uncommon at all in Nigeria. Every election year, 2023 being one such year, sees a massive spike in disappearances and the discovery of sacrificed human beings across the entire nation. When interviewed, locals spoke of a hidden back road, which is kind of interesting. It was barely wide enough for a single vehicle to navigate, which wound its way through the dense woods surrounding this Soka forest that contained the Ibadan House of Horrors. So for over a decade, many had noticed a black jeep that would allegedly appear almost every night. Arriving like clockwork sometime around 8 p.m., it would make its way toward the old secluded buildings deep in the forest, and sometime around 9:30 p.m., usually about an hour and a half, the jeep would be seen again leaving the area. Nobody in the community knew the identity of its driver, only that it was some kind of man. Glimpsed through the fleeting shadows and dim moonlight, they could kind of see that he was a man, but they couldn't really see his face clearly. So nobody knows who this guy was. It appeared that every time the jeep came, screaming would start somewhere in the forest. And the locals knew about this. So this is why I wanted to clarify that there was a residential area surrounding this forest. And you will see on the Google Maps image that I show you if you're watching the YouTube. If you're not watching the YouTube, guys who are listening to the podcast, there is a ton of content in this video. It seems like the locals could have done something about this and failed to, because these these screams and cries would carry through the night air, through the still air of the forest. They would have been able to be heard, and locals reported hearing them. So despite all of this, they only made a few phone calls to the police, and it only took the police saying, basically, we're not coming because it could be anything, a couple times before the general populace around this area just simply gave up. They decided that this was something that was just a part of their lives and a part of their norm. And since the police weren't going to do anything about it, we're just going to let it happen and hope for the best. The locals did report being frustrated and disheartened by the lack of police action, but in my opinion, that doesn't really give them an excuse for just learning to live with these occurrences. And this is exactly how you... Did you guys see that? That was weird. I'm not even sure exactly what turned off, but to put it in perspective, each one of these light bulbs is independently controlled by my phone. So for just one to go off is kind of weird. Anyway, this is how you arrive at a prison state of existence. And this goes for every single listener right now. This is how you arrive at the prison state, where you are basically an NPC, just sort of taking on the day, whatever obscenities or weirdisms that are going on around you. Oh, well, that's just part of my normal. Just got to do my job. Just got to do my little thing and get my little life going and blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, the Ibadan House of Horrors is two blocks away. But, well, I called the police and they didn't do anything, so it must be nothing. Investigators afterwards, after the whole thing went down, claimed that there was absolutely no way that the locals couldn't have known about this horror house based on the stench alone and the screams that were allegedly heard. The smell of decomposing human bodies in the air was smelt from miles away, it said. The locals, though, continued to maintain that the worst they thought maybe it was an insane asylum. Okay. A reporter from the Vanguard penned the following. When Governor Ajimobi got to the scene, he tried to calm the crowd of angry individuals who laid siege to the place, pleading for patience and attention. He explained that the visit was to sympathize with families of those who lost their loved ones to the kidnappers, get to the root of the incident, and get all the suspects arrested. He said, "The reason why we came here today was because of an ugly incident that happened. We were informed that you, the residents, did not know what was happening here. As you did not know, so we too did not know. If you who live in the neighborhood did not know, how then can we who live far away know? But we thank God for exposing all these. All those who did these horrible things, God would expose them. We whom you have entrusted the governance of this state through your votes, God will use us to punish the culprits. As you say amen, God will use us to reform the state. If we would not reform it, God should deny us gaining political power." What the heck? So, hey guys, it's your fault. If you guys didn't know, how the heck are we supposed to know? So if you guys wanted us to come, then you should try a little harder for us to get here. Also, thanks for actually finally getting us here. Now, if you pray real hard, God will keep us in power, and then we can get all the guys who did this, because we don't know where they are or who they are. So we're basically useless unless you guys pray us into continued power. Classic. Absolutely classic. As you did not know, so we too did not know. If you who live in the neighborhood did not know, how then can we who live far away know? Vigilance protecting your people mainly. Okay, moving on. The problem with this statement is everybody knew, and everybody reported it. The police and the government chose not to do anything, so even in this moment, while pleading for silence from the masses and support for further power, the governor basically lies and blames this situation on who exactly? Certainly not themselves. Like we've said before, in Nigeria, the issues of cannibalism and human sacrifice are deeply troubling. With some regions facing a widespread problem where ritualistic killings are fueled by beliefs in this powerful magic, okay? So to meet the demand for these dark practices, so-called witch doctors are said to operate these covert factories that process human body parts. And sometimes it's not the witch doctors who are running the factory, sometimes it's just them buying from the factory. But these factories provide supplies for rituals believed to bring prosperity, protection, or other supernatural benefits. So my point is, it doesn't just have to be big politicians who are benefiting from this kind of trade. And because it is such a widespread issue, being utilized by everybody, from the lowest to the highest, you would think that the police force would sort of have, you know, some sort of process for this. Some sort of way of combating this, some sort of method for investigating this or something. You would have something, I would think. But you know, I'm just a podcaster talking smack from halfway across the world. So who was the guy in the Jeep? Some say he was a witch doctor. Others say an overseer. But some locals actually believe that he was literally just a black market body part supplier. So he would come there and basically get body parts for the black market and sell them. According to some accounts, the man's visit to the warehouse were following a predictable pattern, right? Arriving at 8 o'clock, leaving at around 9:30. He would arrive under the cover of darkness, make his way inside, where he would essentially place an order to the warehouse workers. This is kind of what it's assumed happened. And he would request a specific body part or body parts, each with a particular purpose for the rituals that he supplied. And once the order was given, the workers would then select a captive from among those chained and weakened within the warehouse. And the victim would probably be dragged to a sort of crude, blood-stained slab or table. And the workers would basically sever the requested body parts, offer them up to the buyer, and if the victim survived the whole thing, then they would just be thrown back in captivity. And the man in the Jeep would then take the freshly harvested parts, load them into the back of his vehicle, disappear into the night, and he'd be back on Wednesday or whenever he was coming back, right? That's kind of the general idea. Was the man in the black Jeep simply a middleman, or did he serve a more sinister role in this sort of brutal underworld? What's definitely known is that there are more like him all over Nigeria. Whether there were more like him going to this area, who knows? But the possibility that the horrors of Soka Forest, the Ibadan House of Horrors, were part of a far larger and more orchestrated operation continues to haunt those who remember its story, because it's true. This was just one isolated incident in this massive operation going on in Nigeria, and nowadays so much of the world, that of human trafficking. I mean, no offense, but how many hundreds of thousands of children is it missing from the United States southern border right now? Last I checked, it was like 200,000 children are just missing. Just saying, guys, this kind of stuff touches every country in a different way. Just because it's not the Ibadan House of Horrors, maybe it's the southern border of horrors instead. Just saying. People disappear real easily sometimes. So while the police continued to simply demolish and bury all the evidence, the whole thing, completely seizing hundreds of hectares of land in the process, for use by the state, by the way, Abakuta's friends and family continued to look for him in the area. Many others did the same for their family members as well, looking for the bodies that may be in this area of their lost friends and family. And this led to several mysterious deaths including one where a young boy was murdered by the police for digging in a grave to see if it was one of his family members. He was shot dead, literally executed by the police for this. Abakuta's friends refused to give up hope, and even as the weeks dragged on without any sign of him, they continued their search through the overgrown paths and other abandoned corners of the Soka Forest. Because even though this was an inner city forest, it was a couple hundred acres of forest. As they combed through the edges of the area, they stumbled upon a stranger, and he was being extremely odd and erratic, and he was near the forest edge, and there's just something very off about him. And when the Okada posse confronted him, they searched his pockets and discovered several severed human tongues wrapped in cloth, and alongside them they found a BlackBerry phone. There were a few SIM cards. There was a bunch of money. And because this happened multiple times, these weirdos who would just come with like random objects like that, and those might have just been looters, right? Like, they could have just been demented looters, but having all those tongues is kind of weird, I will say that. And that's exactly what the Okada posse thought, because within moments of finding some of these guys, the situation just absolutely spiraled into violence, and this particular stranger in question was beaten to death, and killings continued, both on behalf of civilians and police. The citizens killed any that they believed could be even remotely responsible for this, and the police did the same, leaving basically no witnesses or suspects that were worth anything. So you have this situation where vigilante justice and what is supposed to be the actual justice are both just killing everybody that could be involved without questioning them, without interrogating them, without seeing what they know, just killing them. And eventually the police did have to come out and say, stop killing everybody because we don't know what's going on if you just kill everybody. But, you know, too little too late for the police. They did not inspire trust within their population. In time, one of the survivors, a woman whose strength had basically slowly returned, was able to give a statement about what happened to her, and she recalled that it all began on what seemed like an ordinary afternoon. She had been sitting peacefully on her porch, enjoying the air, when a van pulled up in front of her home, and to her shock, the van's occupants actually looked disturbingly official. They were dressed in uniforms that either resembled those of law enforcement or some type of government personnel. And they carried themselves with this confidence of authority. So, without a moment's hesitation, they approached her and told her, you're under arrest, lady. And she was stunned, sort of bewildered by their words. And even though she says it felt like something was wrong, she didn't want to cause a scene, so she just got in the van. And reality began to sink in that she hadn't been arrested, she was kidnapped. So after what felt like an eternity, the van finally did come to a stop, and she said that they took her to this black shack that had become infamous among those who knew it, and she saw others there. People who were just like her, huddled together, completely horrified, and they had also been dragged from one of these vans, one by one, treated like objects, stripped of their clothing, and all their clothing and belongings were basically chucked in this shack. And she was trembling as she spoke, but the details of the story were clear. This was no random act of violence. This was an organized operation conducted by people who knew exactly how to use this guise of authority to manipulate their victims. Guys, wake up. It was a chilling reminder that It was a chilling reminder that those behind the horrors of the Soka Forest had carefully crafted their methods, and they used fear and trust alike to turn everyday moments into the first steps of their victim's end. Just rolling up on a nice evening. Hey, you're under arrest. You got to come with us. Yeah, we're with the government. Oh, okay. What for? Well, we'll tell you on the way. Okay. All right. Well, get in the car. Just an old lady. Unreal. Never get in a van, guys. Just, it doesn't matter whose van it is, just never get in a van, period. Among the harrowing accounts shared by those who survived the horrors of the Soka Forest, some revealed an especially grim reality, which is one that you can expect. They had been forced to cannibalism to survive. Many of those trapped in this nightmare were among societies, Nigeria's societies, most vulnerable. They were orphans, they were impoverished, they were elderly, they were people whose disappearances were probably less likely to draw immediate attention. So not all of the victims had been abducted through violence, just taking them like Abakuta probably was. Some were lured into captivity through deceit and false promises. These victims were tricked into believing that they were being offered work or help or some kind of benefit. And then they just find themselves caught in this nightmare reality once they arrived at this forest compound. What had started basically as a lifeline quickly turned into a trap. And their hopes for something better, some benefit that they were about to receive, were extinguished behind these warehouse doors. I just can't even imagine the horror. I can't even imagine it. And after the site was discovered, the police moved in, but as we already said, their response was odd and just wrong. Bodies were just gathered up and buried in mass graves without proper identification or care. They hurried the burial process. And that meant that many of the deceased were left completely nameless, their identities lost in the soil, along with all their stories. And for families searching for closure, this swift cover-up definitely felt like a betrayal and a complete denial of the dignity that their loved ones deserved. This callous handling of the dead sparked a wave of public outrage, as you can imagine. Families who had hoped for answers found themselves faced with indifference and secrecy instead, adding salt to this wound of their loss. And people took to the streets. They started rioting and demanding accountability, and their anger really fueled this hatred in the police and this lack of trust in the authorities because it had been completely shattered. I shouldn't say hatred for the police, but they just didn't trust them at all. So obviously these murmurs grew louder and this public outcry increased. And I'm not going to lie, could it be that the same institutions charged with protecting the people had enabled or even orchestrated the very suffering that had unfolded in the forest? Absolutely. As the scandal grew, so did the sense that the Soka Forest Horror was not just a work of a few criminals. And pretty soon, it was almost guaranteed that it wasn't just the work of a few criminals. It pointed to a much deeper rot within the system. The system that is Nigeria. There is a conspiracy now that reached to the highest levels of power. And that left the nation to grapple with this terrifying realization that those who were meant to safeguard their lives were probably a little bit complicit in their darkest nightmares. Among the survivors was also this woman whose story basically encapsulated the depths of cruelty inflicted in these types of places. And I didn't attempt to make this episode as graphic as possible, but this just happened and is still continuing to happen in Nigeria for a fact. It is being found. These types of situations are being discovered, uncovered. These types of people are being rescued and found dead, unfortunately, constantly. Okay? So some of these stories I did want to tell to show my listeners, to show all you guys, this kind of stuff is not from ancient past. This is from modern times. This woman spoke of being kidnapped and having been taken to the place years prior. And she almost immediately became subject to severe sexual abuse at the hands of her captors. The ordeal was so long that during her time there, she gave birth to 8 children. None of those children, by the way, were identified at the location, most likely being taken for rituals involving fetuses and children. So the horrifying discovery at Soka Forest was just the beginning, though. As the story spread, it led to the uncovering of several other sites of terror. There was a proverbial witch hunt that went on. There were dens of horror all over the place, hidden deep within dense, isolated forests across Nigeria. And these remote locations, even though they were often obscured by miles of tangled vegetation and difficult terrain, were not always hidden deep within the woods. Sometimes they were in more areas closer to residential locations. Rescue operations managed to save hundreds of captives from these hidden prisons, each one of them a story of survival against all odds. And yet, despite these efforts, the scale of the tragedy remained absolutely immense, because thousands of bodies were uncovered and thousands of people were still unaccounted for and still are to this day. I'll just say this as well. Several prominent Nigerian leaders have been found to be guilty of human trafficking and organ harvesting and using black magic and ritual sacrifice of humans for whatever purpose they decide is worth committing such an act. This isn't something that people just assume. These witch hunts do trigger a certain amount of vigor towards finding out the truth. You know, even though Nigeria is overrun by corruption and evil, there are still are good people there, and there still are crime fighters there, and there still are investigators there and journalists who want the real story. And by all of them looking, yes, several people in Nigeria's top elected officials have been taken into custody for these crimes. Not the Soka Forest of Horrors crimes or the Ibadan House of Horrors crimes, but others like it. So we might never know exactly how deep this rot goes, but it's probably safe to say that Nigeria is definitely built on the sand. And there are many stories to this day of individuals who are doused even in oil to be burned for their evils. But for some reason, some of these people just can't be set ablaze because of incantations that they mutter during their executions. Like we said before, though, this witch hunt was not all bad. Some of the bad guys were getting caught, and some of the victims were getting rescued. Several women were rescued from alleged baby factories. Remember when we talked about those in Ukraine? Where they claimed that they had been sold into this trade for 100,000 Nigerian Nairas. And if you're wondering, that is $58.96 in the United States. At the same time, a significant push to reshape the city's image began. Investments poured into Ibadan's tourism sector, transforming its public face completely. Fresh promotional videos and glossy social media posts painted a picture of this beautiful city reborn, showcasing modern developments and cultural attractions and the promise of a, quote, brand new Ibadan for 2023. In a bid to bury the town's dark history, these forces set out to really make Ibadan's reputation on the internet different. And using a mixture of intimidation, suppression, and strategic investments, they accomplished this task. Accounts that dared to speak of the horrors at Soka Forest or share unsettling truths began to face attacks. Social media posts were flagged en masse, leading to takedowns and account suspensions, while vocal critics and independent investigators found themselves targeted by more dangerous methods. Reports emerged of witnesses being silenced, some disappearing without a trace, and others found beaten or threatened into silence. So, even though we're supposed to protect you, you're now ruining the reputation of Ibadan, and therefore, we will now harm you, says the government. Journalists who tried to shed light on the deeper stories behind the disappearances and the alleged government involvement faced violent consequences, with some even dying. Unexpectedly, right? The narrative of a city haunted by its past was drowned out ultimately by these cheerful little ads and travel guides and influencers encouraging people to visit. And you can go on YouTube and check that out for yourself. It's true. Anyone who searched for Ibadan online would now encounter a flood of videos and articles celebrating its revival, with little trace of the chilling events that once destroyed its name, unless you know how to look for those things. But we all know what happened. I know what happened. And now you know what happened. But if you're wondering what's going on at the Ibadan House of Horrors these days, you'd find they built a school on top of it. Reportedly, the school struggles with enrollment. Thanks for checking out 21st Century Dystopian. Don't drink the water and question everything.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.